Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, a lot of us, some of us perhaps more than we should, have been playing different scenarios with the electoral map, seeing what would need to happen for Mitt Romney to score the Electoral College win. And well, something that makes it much easier than if it doesn't happen is a victory in Ohio. That seems to be still a bit of an uphill climb. In fact, one poll shows Romney down 5 points there with the president 50%. But the good news is that Scott Rasmussen in his latest Colorado poll has Mitt Romney, who had been, you know, right there neck and neck with Obama and even a few points behind in recent weeks, now up 4 points, which is probably just outside the margin of error, and Romney right at 50%. So Colorado definitely trending the right way. So if Ohio doesn't happen, and it still could, it's 1 point in a lot of other polls, the combination of Colorado and Wisconsin, or maybe even Iowa, New Hampshire perhaps, means that there's more than one path to this 270, and that's great news.
It is, and it's worth noting, this what's really significant here is movement. You're seeing movement in all of these polls. The last Rasmussen poll in Colorado, which was completed on the 7th of October, about 2 weeks ago, had Obama up by one. Now it's Romney by four, which is a nice 5-point swing. Ironically, the bad news of the day, or what seemed like bad news of the day, that Romney was down 5 in Ohio in the Quinnipiac poll in Ohio, also had 5 points movement. Their preceding one had Romney down 10. So 5-point movement over two swing states in a couple of days is certainly good news. And that's kind of what I'm keeping an eye on now. I mean, we could quibble about that Quinnipiac sample, that it's got Democrats 9 percentage points more than Republicans in Ohio. That strikes me as pretty high. It's higher than it was in 2008. But, you know, there are two things I'm keeping an eye on. One is movement, you know, and it certainly does seem like we are seeing a broad movement towards Romney across both swing states and most national polls, with a couple exceptions. And the other thing that's just fascinating is, where is President Obama as the incumbent in all these polls? As noted in Colorado, Obama's at 46 at Rasmussen, which is not good. You look at where he is in these other Colorado polls, and he's pretty much been averaging 47.7%. It's the number 47, which keeps coming back. You know, poll after poll, day after day, week after week, Greg. And as the Suffolk pollster had said, 47% is a very tough number for an incumbent president. What you can see here of Obama's stops and the strategy here, we've talked in previous Three Martini Lunches about how the Obama campaign is trying to motivate its base. Big Bird and Binders and Ramesia, oh my. Big Bird and Binders and Ramesia, oh my. I don't think any of those are particularly persuasive to the remaining undecideds out there. This is all about bringing out that Democratic base. And I guess the Obama strategy is, if they can get their 47%, pause for irony, to come out, they get 99% of that 47%, that if Romney only gets, 91% of his share of the vote, they can end up with 270 electoral votes. That's not where I would like to be, but I guess when you've been a president for 4 years and people are not on your bandwagon, your options for winning over those last few stragglers are pretty limited. Interesting to hear this morning, Chuck Todd was saying the Obama approach is micro. Birth control and Binders and PBS and Romney's not one of us, says the guy who said there are no red states and blue states back in 2004. Whereas on the macro issues, i.e. the economy, Romney is winning big. I think that's a good outlook for Romney. It's not a perfect one. I think we still, this thing is not in the bag. I think it's very tough to lose the macro issues and make up ground on micro issues. But the Obama campaign and David Axelrod and Messina and all those guys are determined to prove us wrong. And we will see how things shake out in this.
On to the bad martini now, Jim. And just last week, we kind of talked about so many good opportunities to pick up Democratic-held Senate seats. The Democrats did so well in 2006 that they're playing defense in the vast majority of these seats. And we talked about several of the seats that looked like great pickup opportunities. We thought there were four, like right off the bat, that were going to be pretty easy pickups. Nebraska's the only one that's holding true to form, it would seem. North Dakota, for some reason, is tight. Tommy Thompson, you think, would have just crushed Tammy Baldwin. That's neck and neck, and she's ahead in a couple of them. The big one, though, that's gotten a lot of attention over the past couple of months is Missouri. Claire McCaskill basically looked like a poor man's Blanche Lincoln from about 2 years ago, where we're just waiting for the...
Well, she has a private jet, Greg. She's nobody's poor man anything. Where she is a wealthy woman's Blanche Lincoln.
There you go. Well, we thought
a wealthy lobbyist wife's poor Blanche Lincoln.
So you think they were just running out the clock, essentially. But then, of course, Todd Akin with his rape comment, which he apologized for, but nonetheless, he was urged strongly to get out of the race. He decided not to do it. Some polls not that long ago looked like this was a dead heat, maybe even aching up a point, and that got folks like Newt Gingrich, Jim DeMint heavily into this race. And now, in an odd kind of situation, the PPP poll is actually closer in this race than the Rasmussen poll. The PPP's got McCaskill up 6, Rasmussen's got McCaskill up 8, and over 50%. So, Jim, even when your husband's cutting backroom deals in the Senate dining room, apparently if your opponent really sticks the foot in the mouth, it's enough to get you over the finish line, or at least it looks like it's headed that way.
Yeah, and there are some listeners who will probably groan at the fact that we're groaning about this, and I suppose we, you know, should all put on our good, loyal Republican soldier hats and say, oh, let's all go out there with enthusiasm for Todd Akin. You know, it's been, I imagine somewhere at his campaign headquarters, they have one of those great accident update boards. It has been 3 days since our last accident. It has been X number of days since Todd Akin's last egregious foot-and-mouth disease bout. When there was early pressure for Todd Akin to get out of this campaign, a lot of people, myself included, looked at this and said, look, you don't recover from this. People are not going to like the guy. They're just, you know, he came across as if he's fundamentally uninformed about basic human biology. As a result of that, too dangerous to be entrusted with policy decisions. The NRSC and Romney and Ryan and everybody else kind of came out and said, look, we'd really like him to make room for someone else to come in who could win this race against a very vulnerable incumbent. And no, Todd Akin knew better. And his campaign manager, who's his son, knew better. And his wife knew better. And everybody with the last name Akin told us how much better and how much smarter they were than the rest of us. God was on their side. Well, now here we are. I just like to think that God would speak through the Rasmussen organization or through the PPP or through one of these other ones. I am not surprised that he's now down by a steady margin. This is an exceptionally winnable race that was blown entirely. Well, okay. There are people going to complain that I'm speaking past tense, but we got 2 weeks. Unless Claire McCaskill comes out and says that she too doesn't think that rapes can cause pregnancy, that this is not going to go out well for the Republicans. And it's just, you know, just you're left banging your head against your desk that this guy's ego costs the Republicans a seat and possibly won't cost them control of the Senate. And people may wonder why focus on this now. Well, look, the polls are coming out, and a little bit of preemptive observation that, look, we were right, he was wrong, and he has cost Republicans a very winnable seat in this. And it's, as people can tell from the tone of my voice, this is going to be much tougher to get over than the Jets lost to the Patriots last night.
And with Mitt Romney ahead in Missouri by about, 10 or 12 points in some of the recent polls, it's clear that there's not going to be necessarily
a Republican ham sandwich could have carried that seat. Yeah. I was really pulling for ham sandwich as a substitute candidate. No baloney. He's never let you down. No scandals. So.
Yeah, and it's been a pretty solid Todd Akin record over the last decade, but he made a big mistake at the worst possible time. So we'll see what happens. There's still time, and there's a lot of conservative money being pumped in there now, and we'll see if it makes a difference and if this Senate dining room thing happens, but not looking good at the moment. On to martini number three now, Jim. And, you know, it's interesting what a difference a couple of months makes. In early September, Sandra Fluke was on primetime at the Democratic National Convention. Just a couple speakers before Bill Clinton on a very memorable Wednesday night at the convention. Now, apparently her appeal is not quite as strong as she or the Obama campaign thought. She showed up for a campaign event in Reno, Nevada, battleground state. 10 people showed up. There was a picture of it, and I kid you not, the event was held in the parking lot, and in the words of Joe Biden, it literally, the whole campaign event literally took place in the width of one parking spot. So, Jim, 6 or 7 weeks make a big difference in this campaign, as the president's found out, and now Sandra Fluke has found out.
And not only that, Greg, it was a compact car parking space, not even an SUV parking space. You know, I kind of am looking at this and wondering if Sandra Fluke is kind of the Joe the Plumber of this election cycle, that this ordinary figure who suddenly by happenstance gets kind of, you know, elevated to a spokesman for one of or spokesperson for one of the two parties. And I look at that story and you almost feel a little bit sorry for Sandra Fluke. I actually was right behind her on the security line coming back from the Democratic convention in Charlotte. Didn't speak to her, didn't interact with her, but I kind of left wondering like what it's like to be a law student one day, a law student who chooses to go to a Catholic institution and then believes that it's utterly, utterly important that that Catholic institution pay for your birth control. Like if paying for your birth control is really that important to you, you'd think you might have gone to, you know, any one of the other fine law schools that are not Catholic institutions. But as a result of this, you get called the S word by Rush Limbaugh, and you know the president gives you a phone call to cheer you up after that, and you turn into this national figure. You get asked to speak at the convention, and your entire convention speech is about this post-apocalyptic future under Romney and Ryan in which no one has access to birth control, etc. and at some point, when, like, you know, you get that great moment in which you walk out on the stage in Charlotte and everybody's applauding and chanting your name, and you should know, okay, I've enjoyed my ride. Now it's time to go back to life of being a law student. And instead, she's decided to go on this speaking tour and try to help out, become a celebrity, so to speak, for Democratic candidates. There was some story about her in the Washington Post style section, but there was this small point that said that she's paying her own way to do all these trips, which, Mo Lane had said, look, if people are going to want you to come out to speak to your rally, you make them pay. You don't do that stuff for free, which maybe is a phrase I should probably avoid when discussing Sandra Fluke and birth control. But nonetheless, she's just kind of almost with the feeling she's almost being exploited by all this. I mean, who invited her out to Reno? Who decided that she'd be a big draw in Reno? And who said, oh, let's do it in a great big parking lot? You know, you feel kind of like she's just kind of this person who's kind of been thrust into these circumstances. She doesn't know anything about presumably, campaign events and optics and planning and all that kind of stuff. She needs a better agent, Greg. She really does kind of, they're booking her in the wrong clubs and wrong place. Who figured Reno would be the big Sandra Fluke, location? Just, it's bizarre and a little bit sad. And it's kind of like watching for example, I just found out that Tommy Two Tone is going to be playing in an ice rink near, and it's. Yeah, I like 867-5309 as much as the next guy. The fact that they're playing the opening of an ice rink is kind of sad. And we're now in the later chapters of Behind the Music of the Sandra Fluke story. So,
but there's always an upswing. So, let's just hope it's well after the election and completely unrelated to the election.
Maybe she'll be huge after the election. Who knows? But just kind of sad to see, maybe there was something big going on in Reno that day. Some, matinee movie or something. Something that, threw her away. Either way, you kind of look at her and say, you know what? I don't want to be the headline act for any of these things. I'll be the opening act for somebody else with a bigger name. What's she got to say that you got to go and see it in person?
Well, it is the biggest little city in America. And it's interesting that the line that the president keeps using in his stump speech when it comes to contraception is the Romney Ryan ticket wants to take you back to the 1950s. No. Just to July 31st, when you had to pay a little bit copay for your birth control.
That's all. Is that plus, hey, what was our unemployment rate in the 1950s? I'm not saying everything was great about the 50s. I'm just saying there are certain parts, it's not so crazy to look back upon with nostalgia. So
yeah, guessing the debt was lower then too. Just a hunch. Jim, have a great day.
Looking forward to tomorrow, Greg. See you tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today. Enjoy the debate tonight, and don't forget to join us again tomorrow for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.